Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. Then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me. And walk this lovely land with me. When you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening, happy Shabbat, and welcome. We're going to recommence as we had left off in Yeshayah 3:12 this evening. It's kind of one of the most provocative statements we've had to analyze. So, Kirk, we're going to jump right into the doghouse probably. But up there in Northern California, you're lucky to be alive.
Well, we're not too bad shape other than the breathing, which if it kept going on, it's pretty bad when you walk your dog at night and the moon is orange. That's just scary. You know, I thought about it, the things where the sky is so filled with stuff you can't see the stars, and it was like
yeah.
this one night.
Yeah, no, one time I was in Santa Barbara, and we had one of those fires, the tea fire in particular, and I was so close to it, and it was so massive that it actually turned the sun that deep reddish orange so that you could look right at the sun. And I would have obscured the moon. But it does give you this idea of what the atmosphere is going to be like in the last days as the moon is obscured. It's kind of why I'm always kind of chuckle at the observation versus astronomical evaluation of the Moed Mikre, and particularly the most important one, because the most important Moed Mikre is the one that is will be celebrated on our horizon, which is the return of Yahweh. And it's going to be on Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah, which is 6:22 p.m. on October 2nd, 2033. And this is why I get a chuckle out of it. Reminding me of it is, well, the atmosphere is going to be so obscured by that time, you wouldn't be able to see a full moon, much less the first sliver of the moon. And so 10 days into the seventh month, how in the world are you going to tell that? Impossible. So you're not going to know it from an observational point of view. You're going to have to calculate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that big a deal. And that's going to be one of the times where calculation is the only thing that's going to work, because the atmosphere is going to be just like what you're experiencing there in Northern California. You said that, because the last numbers that I read on that fire is that they had taken, the first it was like 4 or 5 were killed, and then it was like 10 or 15. And now I hear that the numbers of missing that have been missing now for better part of a week, that they're begging people to check in.
Mm-hmm.
But the number of missing is somewhere between 800 and 1,000.
That's the two numbers that have been pushed around. So I'm hoping you hope they're wrong, that they just are off somewhere in a shelter or something. But I would think by now.
But everybody in the shelters just checks in and we're such a connected world today that and everyone knows if you lived in that area, the authorities need you to check in because they're trying to ascertain the whereabouts of people. And you know, they sent those cadaver dogs into that scene. And what I read about these cadaver dogs on that scene is that there's so much carnage there that the dogs don't even know how to handle it.
Yeah.
These dogs are normally extraordinarily disciplined, just don't know how to handle it. By the way, I went puppy shopping about 3 or 4 days ago. Found a really first-rate breeder of labs down in South Florida, and you have to interview to get a lab. Now, they won't sell you a lab; you have to interview to qualify for one of their labs. And you know, it was just amazing as to you know, how extraordinary these dogs and how well they're bred and you know all the things that they can do. But I think I'm going to name my this yellow lab, and they don't allow the prospective pet owners to pick out the dog after they've done multiple interviews with the prospective owners. And they've gotten to know the dog. They choose the dog they think is best for that particular situation. But I whatever this dog is, I'm expecting to name her the female yellow lab Asher.
Asher, of course.
Yeah, you know. So I've got two things. And you know, Kara is the name of my boat, which is still in the boatyard. Hopefully, I'll get her sometime within the week. But Asher. Because Asher is really the word that has meant more to me than anything else, and you know, it's the welcome walk, it's the beneficial path, it's the glue of relationships, the essence of relationships, if you will. You know, dogs are so relationship oriented, and you know that they're so endearing to walk and give meaning. To many aspects of life, make it more enjoyable. So I think Asher will be my puppy's name. And Kara, welcoming invitation, is the name of the heretofore unseen boat. It's looking better and better each day. It's coming around, but it's still not here, becoming a labor of love down here in South Florida.
Sounds cool.
So I hope that that the numbers aren't as bad as they sound out of California, but oh my goodness, that is it's going to rank up there as one of the most devastating than travesties in terms of weather related, or you know, it's not just weather related, but it's a natural disaster in recent American history.
You know, the one thing that is so sad because it happened so fast and there were no warnings really. There was a lot of mobile home retirement sections there, and a lot of those people are quite old. We have them here because we're right next to a rather gigantic lake, and a lot of mobile homes neighborhoods approaching that. And the trouble with that is when you get that old and there's no time, there's no way to evacuate them in a small town. It's not like they have 20 brushes sitting there just to go to each one or something.
Right. Well, a huge percentage of people that tried to evacuate in their cars.
Yeah.
They burned alive in their cars.
Horrible. Just horrible.
Yeah. If you stayed in your home, you were burned alive. And if you got in your car, you were burned alive.
Mm-hmm. Some of those, they showed films of them photographing as they were driving through the fire. Obviously, those were the ones that got through, but I couldn't see where there was an opening, and they just kept on plowing through. You worry about your car blowing up then. I mean, it is a gas vehicle. Anyway, just awful.
It's awful, and you know, and as tragic as that was, to look at entire communities just ashen, and 1,000 people dead. It's the carnage of what's on our horizon. Pales by comparison. Speaking of carnage, I announced that I had finished my translations of Yahshua Isaiah 15 and 16 last week. And this week I was able to finish all the commentary for them. So I actually sent off to Jackie for the first time in many months. I completed a new chapter. It's chapter 11 of volume 2. And I got two more chapters to do, and volume 2 of Observations for Our Time will be a wrap. So I'm now in chapter 12. I made some progress on it today, but it was nice. Boy, what a thrill it was to send off to Jackie a new chapter the first time. I've sent one in her direction to edit now in a very, very long time.
Yeah.
Well, big time fun for me. All right, so this is where we left off.
What was the overall view? I mean, what was the most? I don't want you to give it all away because we're not there yet. But what hit you? You know, a lot of times you mentioned when you're ahead, what really hit you the most? What do you think?
Yeah, the overwhelming insight is the analysis all suggests to me that Moab has almost nothing to do with the country that was to the southeast of Israel. The prophecy doesn't fit them. It's set into a context of last days. They faded into oblivion during the Persian period, and so it just makes no sense unless you're analyzing Moab as what Moab represents, what the name represents, that it's Ab, followed by the Ma, which is the interrogatory. So it's you know, question the father, this questionable father. And so it's the, you know, I looked at Moab as representing the institutions fathered by the adversary, religion and politics. And the thing that was, I guess, the most insightful is where Yahweh goes, it just is very bluntly, and say that the spirit behind Moab is demonic. It's a it's an evil spiritual influence, and he talks about the kind of the entire nature of the adversary and his involvement with political and religious leaders. And then making it very clear that that he's going to clean house. So there are a lot of statements reaffirming this idea that I've had for a long time, that there's been hints at everywhere. And I'm not, you know, that certain places seem to suggest that it's a literal interpretation, but supposedly me just piecing together all of the parts that just before Yahweh returns, he's going to clean house. He's going to start with Israel, and every trace of religion and politics and all of those who embrace religion and politics are just going to be gone. All military hardware, all government apparatus, all shrines, temples, mosques, obliterated.
Mm-hmm.
He's just going to clean house. And then he's going to start there, and he's just going to spread. It's going to spread around the entire globe. And anybody that was antagonistic towards Israel, anyone that hadn't become part of the covenant, anyone that was religious or political at that time is just going to be eliminated. Because God can't live in a polluted environment. He's not going to exist in a polluted environment, just like he can't bring the religious into his home. Well, he can't come home to Israel while there's a religious or political influence. So the earth is going to be transformed into the conditions that existed in the Garden of Eden. Okay, no politics, no government, no religion, no police, no authority, no armies, no corruption, no perversion. And so that it was made painfully clear as we go through that that particular prophecy. And there were aspects of it that were very Islamic, far more that were Christian. And by aspects of it, I'm talking about condemnations. Condemnations of Christianity, condemnations of Islam, condemnations of the adversary, condemnations of government and religion. So, and in the middle of it, there is a point where God says, you know, but it's not the case for everybody. There will be those who are observant, those who take the time to know who I am, what I'm asking, what I'm offering, who contemplate and exercise good judgment about what I've revealed, that are going to be protected, and that and they're going to reach out and protect others. And he's gives some interesting instruction to his children as to what he expects of us, and how he expects us to act. There was even a really nice affirmation of this idea, Kirk, that Yahweh knows those who are going to choose him before we make that choice. And in this particular case, there's a statement where there's some invited guests, people who have chosen to live within Israel, who are foreigners. But at a time when you know, Israel is being attacked on all sides, people say, you know, I'm kind of like Ruth, you know, that the story of Ruth. Your people are my people. Your God is my God. Where you go, I'm going to go. Yeah, there's a lot of people that are going to make that same decision, that are going to be foreigners, like Ruth was, and said, you know, this is what I'm going to do. And Yahweh tells those who are part of his covenant, protect them, shelter them, keep them out of harm's way, protect them from the adversary. And the reason is that while they've made the decision to walk away from, you know, religion and politics, and they've made the decision to live within Israel, they haven't yet made acted upon the terms and conditions of the covenant. And so God is telling his covenant children to protect them. What that says is that Yahweh knows that there's a reason to protect them. They need the time to respond to him. That he's revealed himself to them in such a way, made an introduction, that Israel's God is their God. And so before they've made that commitment, he says, I want you to go out of your way to protect them, provide shelter for them. So it's a really an interesting, so there's just so many things like that could take the time to say, well, what are the implications of this statement? So I really had a lot of fun writing it. Now, that's not the short answer that you asked for, but
that's the
part that I enjoyed. All right, in fact, there's even a part of this particular passage that I learned as I was writing that chapter. Because my people, my family, exploit and oppress. They claim authority to control others, imposing their will on them. Request, require, and exact payments, which cause hardships and are troubling. Before we press on, Kirk, you know, I struggled with this. And I struggled with it because with one very short exception, Israel was not in the tribute game. Israel has not been an outward conqueror. They don't go and conquer other countries and extract tribute or plunder. Every other religion man has invented has been used by despots the world over, including socialist secular humanism, to expand and to plunder and to tax and to control others, to oppress them. And communism, Nazism, socialist secular humanism, now Christianity, oh my goodness, Islam, to a horrible degree. But Israel, no. So it's just, why is God blaming them for oppressing and exploiting people? You know the answer? I didn't figure out the answer until 60 seconds ago, so I wouldn't hold it against you if you don't know.
No, they were exploding their own people.
So you already knew it. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Rabbis exploit Jews. They don't exploit Gentiles.
They exploit jealous. Yeah.
Right.
Horrible.
Right. And so it's when he says, my people exploit and oppress. Who are they exploiting and oppress? They're exploiting and oppress God's chosen people.
Mm-hmm.
Their brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And family. You know, with the whole world trying to exploit and oppress Jews, God said, you know, them, Israelites, you're oppressing one another. Now, you could extrapolate and say, well, you know, Muhammad was Jewish.
Well, you know.
Hitler was Jewish.
But,
you know, Lenin, Marx, Jews. And so individual Jews, although pretending not to be Jews, hiding the fact that they were Jews, have oppressed a lot of people. But I don't think that's what he's talking about here. I think what he's talking about here is the obvious. That Jews have swindled Jews. So my people exploit and oppress. They inflict pain and deal harshly as a result of their immaturity. Jews, with very, very few exceptions, haven't dealt harshly with anyone. They're dealt harshly with. They're dealt more. People the world over have dealt more harshly with Jews than against any other race.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing even compares to how harshly the world has treated Jews. And while there are some notable exceptions, I was reading about Moab because they're doing those prophecies, and once Dode, and he had reason to go against them, but once he fought off Moab and had hostages, he killed 2 out of 3 of them, of the hostages. And you know, you might say, well, that's a really bad. Hardest thing to do, and really it wasn't. And it's because the teaching of Yahweh goes back, and we'll consider this in a moment, goes back to the Exodus, where the Moabite women used sexual favors to persuade Israelite men to worship the Lord Baal.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a deadly plague that Dode had. There was no life expectancy for any of these people. They were all going to die, and there would be no life after death, except for the worst of them, who would live eternally in Sheol. And so, you know, it's just like in your home, if you have a bunch of rats that are infected with the bubonic plague, then killing them is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Shemosh, which was the, and Baal were the two names of the, and Astarte were the names of the deities of Moab. That thing they wanted the most was to control Israel through assimilation, through multiculturalism. And that's the one thing that Yahweh wanted to prevent, which is why Dode did away with it. But I only mention it because other than that, it's strictly Jews dealing harshly with Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, Yahweh says it's because of their immaturity that they play dirty, childish schemes. They're capricious. And that resonates with me, that concept. concept. Mm-hmm. And the reason it does is I just think of people today, and I don't care what their age is. The vast preponderance of people have somehow surrendered their ability to think. They aren't judgmental. They aren't discerning. They're not discriminating. And as such, they act in a childish way. It's just they've never grown up. And such a high percentage of older people do are still acting as if they were kids. And I went to a series of nightclubs the other night, a buddy of mine down here in South Florida. It was all good fun, just two of us. He wanted to take me to his favorite the joints that were had pickup bands that were blues and jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And the music was spectacular. But almost all of those on instruments and singing were in their 60s and 70s. These were old dudes, man, but they were rocking it. And the audience was filled with, these were not young groupies. I mean, the youngest person in the audience that we went to was probably 50. They went from 50 to 80. Most of them, they just never did grow up. There was even one of them, there was a rabbi playing the harmonica. And all of his black and little yarmulke and the whole bit. But it's just, people haven't grown up. To grow up, you have to accept responsibility. To grow up, you need to think rationally. You need to be discerning and discriminating. You've got to have enough character and backbone to stand up against societal influences. Well, so many people the world over, and they say, and even Israel, they just have never grown up. So then, and this is the line, feminine influences, women, female individuals, exercise authority over them because they're just like them. We'll return to that in a moment. My people, your guides, lead you astray. And the courses of your path have thoroughly confused and hopelessly befuddled you. Bala. They mislead you. They confound you to the point which you no longer process information rationally. And, for most of human history, Jews have been extraordinarily religious, and the religion is preposterous.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Jew, Sheol, or Shaul, Paul, that created Christianity. The religion is preposterous. I mean, you have to be a nincompoop, an unthinking, blathering buffoon, to be a Christian. I'm sorry, it's just stupid. And to think of how stupid that is, Islam, the Quran, is not only written in Hebrew, it's largely based on the Talmud.
Yes.
And it's just incomprehensible how such a contradictory, utterly ridiculous, clearly wrong religious mantra was ever attributed to God and how it became successful. And so people have been led down paths that are totally befuddling. And what God is saying is that, the guides led them astray to the point they're totally befuddled, but they would not have been led astray had they been observant.
Correct.
I was led astray. I was a Christian. I was led astray. I was a conservative Republican. I was led astray. I was a flag-waving, patriotic American. I was led astray. Why? Because I was ignorant. I don't think I was irrational, but I certainly, my faith required me to be irrational, so I must have been. I didn't think of myself as irrational, but clearly I was, because I accepted hundreds and hundreds of impossible contradictions.
Yeah.
But I was ignorant of who Yahweh is, what his name is, what he had to say, and how his testimony and his nature is so opposite the contradictory nature and really foolish nature of religion. I mean, what kind of a God would want to be worshipped by his creation? What a ridiculous idea.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the dumbest idea that's ever been perpetrated in the name of religion is dead God on a stick. Tortured and dead God on a stick. A Christian crucifix.
Sounds so ridiculous at this point, doesn't it?
Oh,
I mean,
but we're going to make our symbol a tortured and dead God on a stick.
Yeah. Follow him.
Or this notion, my God died so you could live. Huh? Man killed God? And killing God causes you to live? Are you crazy? So, I'm just amazed, but nonetheless, God is saying your guides, those who lead the way, pronounce blessings. That would be rabbis today in the Jewish world. Have led you astray. They've caused you to wander away, and your paths have thoroughly confused and hopelessly befuddled you. And the reason that's the case is that once you are overtly political, you form opinions that are so far afield from reality that the truth is totally alien to you. You can't even process it. And if you're religious, you're allergic to the truth. Anything that demonstrates that your religion is false, you can't even begin to assimilate such information. So you're hopelessly befuddled. There's no reaching the religious or political. Now, I would tell you, Kirk, that we begin the study, we're ahead of ourselves here. You and I have read it. Maybe some of those that are listening have read it. But beginning about the 16th statement through the 24th verse of Yeshayahu 3, we're at 12 now. That's a big swath, the 16th, all the way through the 24th statement of Yeshayahu 3, is a no-holds-barred, overt expose condemning religious dress up.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in that light, you can't just write off this feminine influence as being spiritual, as in the Whore of Babylon. Well, I think the Whore of Babylon is a big part of this for sure, this negative feminine influence, because you're just like them. Yeah, they hoard themselves out to the Babylonian gods. And that clearly is part of it. But God would not have gone to such lengths to talk about religious dress-up and condemn religious dress-up, particularly on women, if there wasn't more to it than that.
What I went through today, translating in yesterday, because I spent 2 days on, like I told you, on two verses, God, really, you think you can't stand a religious dress-up and women wearing all these things. He is horrified and disgusted by it. And he doesn't,
yeah, I don't think there's anything, Kirk, that bothers me more.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with that now, particularly after having translated Yeshayahu 3, 16 through 24. And the reason I'm so happy with it now is that When I have a harsh reaction, when I have a viewpoint that's so counter to what is considered appropriate, and then I find that Yahweh has exactly the same viewpoint, then I think, well, then you know I'm making progress. You know, there's hope. I am making progress because I want.
I
want my perspective to be the same as his.
Is that
right?
I found even more than you did.
Yeah, so we'll get to that in a moment. So there's clearly the realization that that God hates religious dress up and the women who wear it, and he hates it for the same reason I hate it. How in the world could you be so stupid? to wear the garb of a false god. Every day of your life, to put on costumes that honor false gods. I mean, can you imagine being the real God and looking down at a woman wearing a hijab? And as God said, I made you beautiful. I made you attractive. And here, you're wearing a religious tent. Makes you look hideous. I don't know why anybody would cut themselves off for the truth the way they do. And, you know, the Amish with their little costume, the Mennonites with their costumes. Religious Jews, you know, wearing the little curly cues and the black hats and the little black suits. And, oh, God, it's disgusting. So, there is an axis of evil that we've been confronted with since we began Observations for Our Time. We first confronted this axis of evil in Proverbs 6. It's Babel, which is Babylon, Hasatan, the adversary, and Shaul, the plague of death, Paul, in Christianity. And we've discovered that there's a whore. Her name is Astarte. She's the Queen of Heaven and the Mother of God. As the Madonna and Child, she is the basis for Easter. And she was integrated into Christianity. So, to some degree, to a large degree, that's the feminine aspect that of being led down the wrong path that Yahweh was referring to. Now I want to get into some quicksand here, and if there ever was a man who loved women and stood strong against and opposition to the abuse of women, that's me. I think I share Yahweh's love of women and his view of the empowerment of women. But he created us differently. We are different. I celebrate those differences. I think those differences are marvelous, and life is vastly richer when men and women get together and enjoy those differences. But I want to focus here just on what are the differences between the leadership of men and women. And now, by the way, a lot of this has been mitigated in the last 50 years in the West, certainly not in the Islamic world, but in the West, with role reversal. A lot of it transpired when they began to change testing, such that the parts of, for example, the SAT test, the college entrance test that men were good at, rational thinking, analogies, that sort of thing, and the like, and they remove them. And the things that women were best at, like creative writing, they added. They profoundly altered the test to the detriment, purposely to the detriment of boys and then to favor women. And then they took Title IX and they said that the scholarships that are given to men, and particularly in sports, that make the university money and cause the large donations to come to the university, that if you offer those to a football team, which maybe is a 150 scholarship, then you have to give women an equal number of scholarships in broom hockey and cheerleading, non-revenue sports. The combination of it just profoundly changed the demographics in colleges. Colleges were 60-40, 60% men, 40% women, and now they're 70-30, 70% women, 30% men.
I didn't realize that. Wow.
And with that transition between men and women, and you're prepared to earn a living, homes are fundamentally changed. The women are out earning the living, and the men are at home. It's changed society. So much of this no longer is the way that it was, but some things still have a legacy. So let's just talk a little bit about this. And I don't want to pick up any more foes than I already have, but an argument can be made that while women are generally smaller and weaker physically than men, they can be more cunning. They're not immune to using sex to influence both men and women. And it's interesting today that while about between 1% and 2% of men, almost no matter what age, are homosexual, and about 1% to 2% of men are bisexual. Today, the percentage of women, particularly women under 30 who are bisexual, 35% to 40%.
You're kidding.
No. No, women are today, particularly a woman under 20, a woman under 30 actually today is as likely to be bisexual as she is not. So women are going to use sex not only against, right, to influence men, but to influence other women. And they're somewhat more disposed to play emotions or play on emotions than take a stand on evidence and reason. So while this is a generality, and there are many exceptions to this rule, we ought not to ignore Yahweh's propensity to use whore and harlot to convey the adversary's allure. Now, as an example of this, in Bamidbar, Numbers 25, 1 and 2, it reads, while addressing the worship of the Lord Baal of Peor during the Exodus, while Yisrael was staying at Shittim, the people began to have sexual relations with the women of Moab. These invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people bowed down to their gods. It wasn't the men that lured them into the worship of Baal. It wasn't men that caused them to bow down to false gods. Was women.
Yeah. But wasn't it always, though, the women in the temples that lured them to begin with?
Almost every religion, and this was prominent amongst the Moabites, and we know this now for certain, not only because Yahweh spoke of it, but we have the Moabite stone.
Mm-hmm.
It reveals the nature of the Moabite religion. And we've unearthed a Moabite shrine. Oh, it was all based on sexual religious rites. Absolutely. Most religions had temple priestesses who were prostitutes.
Yes.
Now, second and closer to home. In America, following women's suffrage in 1920, the U.S. military has grown from essentially irrelevant to the most imposing force the world has ever known, more powerful than the rest of the world's militaries combined. During the same period of time, a solvent nation has become bankrupt, evolving from an era of personal responsibility and independence to a welfare state rife with entitlements, which fostered dependence upon government. And I would add that while the irrational, inconclusive, peace-promoting, and tolerant nature of political correctness, the most pervasive and destructive influence on humankind today, it's far more feminine in its nature than it is masculine. Third, in the Torah, HaSatan found Yahweh easier to beguile than Adam. He used fallacies of selective evidence and incomplete evidence, intermixing truth with lies, taking testimony out of context, misquoting the message. He failed a score of rational fallacies. I've spoken of the fact in the past that men and women are wired differently, and I used the example of LASIK to share this, where women are capable of multitasking, which isn't something that Yanoa likes, where men are more adroit at focusing, and God wants our undivided attention. Fifth sense faith, in the face of evidence to the contrary of one's beliefs, is an emotional response. There's an argument here for faith versus reason in this feminine influence. Until quite recently, it could be said that women were generally more emotional than men, and that men were more likely to reason their way through conflicts. And while this distinction is rapidly waning and with the attack on the traditional gender roles, and by the college entrance process that I've spoken of.
Mm-hmm.
As suggested by this prophecy regarding the last days, the religious faith of both men and women will cause both genders to forego reason. But I want to drive this point home. I did some research on this.
Okay.
On any given Sunday in an average church, 61% of the congregation are female. Only 39% are male. Fully 25% of married women worship without their husbands. Overall, there are 13 million more women than men in America's churches. In 2014, Pew Research revealed that in the United States, more than 60% of women said that religion was very important in their lives, and 64% pray to their God daily, while less than 47 per men concurred or did likewise.
Big difference.
This gender divide is worse during the week, where 70 to 80% of the participants in sanctioned church activities are female. 70 to 80%. Surveys reveal that 75% of boys who are raised in church will abandon their religion in their early teens. Most will never return. Only one adult male in six attends church. One in six. While most all churches have vibrant women's programs, fewer than one in ten offer men's ministries. In Europe, Africa, and Asia, the gender gap is even more extreme, with women comprising nearly 90% of the parishioners on Sunday mornings.
Jeez.
Apart from Christianity, the results of the Pew Research study paint a very different picture. And at least for the 84 countries whose citizens took part in the poll, globally and excluding Christianity and all but one of the remaining religions, women are only slightly more religious than men. 83% of females identified themselves with the faith compared to 80% of men. So in India, the Hindu religion, men and women are equally beguiled. In Islam, it's the same. There's no distinction between men and women in Islam. It's Christianity. Therefore, the facts affirm that Christianity is dominated by women. And in context of criticizing religious behavior, especially in the light of what Yahweh has said about Shaul, the plague of death, and Astarte, the mother of God and queen in heaven, the Mary with their child in Christianity. Christianity may represent the negative feminine influence God is saying will adversely influence humankind in the last days. So that, my friend, is my journey down that slippery slope of just sharing the possibilities. And I've said this before, and I want to repeat it because this is a good time to repeat it.
Okay.
Well, when I translate Yahweh's words, so long as I do my job, and you've checked up on me lots of times, Kirk.
Oh, yeah.
So long as I do my job reasonably well, and I'm diligent at it, I'm open-minded, I'm paying attention, and I've goofed from time to time, but the result is going to be true. Yeah, was a perfect communicator. He's always right. Mm-hmm. Now, when I try to explain Yahweh's word, then, you know, I can hear. It's incumbent on me to do that because, boy, I found a whole lot of insights that later I found affirmed over and over again by God. And I do think that this one is affirmed, that he is talking about human women and the negative influence because of what follows in 16 through 23 of this same chapter. You know, always be open to the realization that I'm prone to error. And if you disagree, I'm certainly not going to go to the mat with you on this one. You're free to disagree and challenge anything I've said in this regard.
You just finished 3:12, and it says the people oppressing my people. You know, it talks about women and they rule over them, and it talks about their guides, which are leading along a different path.
Right.
They use misleading deception. That's what the words are. I mean, it's a lot more than that. I mean, it's the ones who stagger due to intoxication. They turn, the law is they turn to devour, destroy. The road, the path that you travel, and divert it to another path. How do you mistranslate that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not picking on anybody. It's just that's the way it is. I mean, I never, when I was a little kid, the only time we went to church was when Mama took us because Dad played golf. He didn't want a part of it. And I only became.
And my family, my mother was the religious one. Not my father.
Yeah, it was a thing. Yeah. So, you know, stupid me, but and smart old man, but he didn't figure out the other part.
That's
how it really was there.
Yeah.
But you can't argue with that. I mean, it's
no, the facts on Christianity in terms of the feminine participation are just so overwhelming. And facts are facts. We can come to different conclusions, but we can't have different facts.
No.
And the facts on the influence of America following the women's suffrage movement are undeniable.
Mm-hmm.
And you can try to talk them away, but that was the profound change. The results are not favorable.
Mm-hmm.
For this reason, Yahweh stands up. He has, is, and will take a stand. He is properly stationed. He's rigid, solid, unwavering, prominently positioned, determined, and steadfast to actually oppose and to hostily contend with them, to dispute and quarrel with them, to file a complaint and bring legal charges against them. So much for the judge not lest you be judged, huh? Showing hostility towards them, to ridicule them, to taunt them, to mock them, to insult them, to argue against them. Oh, boy. I love it when Yahweh is conveyed doing the things that I think are so essential. We ought to mock religion.
Yeah.
We ought to ridicule it. We ought to insult the lack of thinking that is required to be religious. God does. And then he will judge these people.
Yes, that's what it says.
Now, Kirk, as you know, you don't want to be judged by God. There's only one of two outcomes. If you're judged by God, one of two outcomes.
That or live
in annihilation of the soul or eternal damnation. That's it.
That's it. And that's fair.
Right. But this is, you know, this all-loving God. An all-loving God does not stand up to actually oppose and hostily contend with them, to quarrel with them, to file a complaint against them, to ridicule, mock, and insult them, to argue against them. I think not.
Yeah. if he didn't hate the preacher, Yahweh didn't hate the preacher that would have led my soul to Shaul, then he ain't much a friend of mine.
That's right.
I mean,
you can't be protective and loving of your family if you allow, support, tolerate, accommodate those who would do them harm. So in spite of the mindless chants proclaimed by the politically correct, hate is a virtue. Without hate, love is shallow. Justice is without consequence. There is no distinction between our response to good or evil. When we refuse to hate that which is harmful, we cease to care for those we love. The only rational, compassionate response to pedophiles, to rapists, to slave traders, to terrorists, to arsonists, to drug dealers, to warmongers, to mass murderers, is to hate and to oppose them because of the harm they inflict on others. And while these behaviors are heinous, there's something far more destructive, far more deadly, far more deserving of our hate. Deception is promoted by religious and political leaders because they lure people away from God.
Well, that kills your soul.
Correct. Now, Yahweh doesn't just talk the talk, he walks the walk. With the exercise of good judgment, Yahweh will commence against the religious and societal leaders of his people and the government officials thereof, because you have senselessly removed the vineyard. The possessions stolen from the afflicted and oppressed are in your homes and temples. Mishpat. The exercise of good judgment.
Disputes.
Yeah. For the means to resolve disputes. So with the exercise of good judgment, Yahweh will come to pursue, participate, and engage against the religious and societal leaders, Zaken, the dignitaries, the elders, the community leadership. Did you have any opportunity to check up on Zaken?
Zaken, the elders, the senior, the old men and women, senator senior from Zaken, a verb to become old, but based on the family, community, wise by virtue of age and experience, leader. Adjective. So
yeah,
it doesn't make them good. They make them good. That's just, you know, we allow the older, we think they're wiser. But they're
I realize that the lexicons, a lot of times you can take words from lexicons and jot them all down, and most of them can be wrong. You notice here, I only had one word that would be related to old, and it was elder.
Yeah.
The elders in society. Because in those societies, when you use the term Zaken, it wasn't a term that would be to use for seasoned citizens. It wasn't a term used to describe the old or the feeble or the those in retirement homes.
No.
That's not what this was. It wasn't about retirement age. It wasn't about the golden years. It wasn't about being a seasoned citizen.
No.
So Ken was used to describe the people who were in charge of the community, religiously and politically.
Well, what I got next was pretty much that. I've got chieftains, captains, princes, official rulers, overseers, and taskmasters, the one who turns people in his his direction.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, that's what the word was
supposed to be. Duker, but that's the initial blast you'll get from a lexicon, and then if you keep on digging, it'll tell you exactly what it is. Yeah. So correct.
Right. Because if you were to translate it just elders, and you think of society today, well, the elders are the people today, with exception of, I was an ordained ruling elder when I was a young person in my teens, and the Presbyterian Church above the youngest in history. And so there is an elder is the term for a religious leader. And I was a religious leader, I'm embarrassed to say.
Look what you
and that's the way the term was perceived back then. It was a term to describe those who had risen to the predominant leadership roles within society. And in ancient world, it was kind of like the unions today. You progress in a union with the advance of time, not ability.
Education was that way.
Education is that way today, sure.
Yeah, because if
the military is that way today. You go up in rank based upon the length of time that you have served.
The number of days and the years.
Military rank is based on a growing older scale. And, there are no young popes. So that's what they were referring to, of his people. And the government officials, just in case you didn't pick up on the fact that the societal and religious leaders were the ones that God was going to exercise good judgment against, he says government officials.
Hard to miss that.
Yeah. High-ranking military officers, royalty, commanders, princes, and political rulers. Now, Tsar isn't one of the words that they even obfuscate, is it, in the lexicons?
Tsar, what I got was to be stubborn and turn from the correct path, to tie up. Tsar was to tie up, bind, and imprison. So there's some reference.
Yeah. But the direct definition of Tsar is government officials, high-ranking military officers, royalty, commanders, princes.
Government or lords.
Rulers.
Yeah.
Because you have senselessly removed the vineyard. What's the vineyard?
The vineyard is, we'll refer to that to Israel and the place to grow the family.
Israel is a vineyard, isn't it?
Yeah.
But there's a vineyard within the vineyard.
There's a vineyard in
I planted a vineyard with God.
Yes.
And I had him cultivated. And yet you destroyed it. What's the vineyard that God planted?
All his Psalms.
His fruit is the Psalms.
Yeah,
his fruit is in the Psalms. That's the fruit that planted by God. And of course, the vineyard represents wine. And wine represents Pesach, the path to eternal life.
Well, that means you can't be a Baptist, you can't drink.
No, the Baptists, they want the baptism, which does no good at all, but you can't have the wine, which is part of the Pesach meal. You can't be intoxicated with alcohol, but you sure as hell can be inebriated with their faith.
With Pauline theology, yeah.
Yeah.
Plague of death. Venom.
Without wine, without the vineyard, there is no life. We need to be grafted into the vine that is rooted in Israel. And then God says, the possession stolen from the afflicted and the oppressed. Who are the afflicted? Don't rabbis tell Jews to afflict themselves, particularly on Yom Kippur?
Well, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Those have been harassed and impoverished. Well, their property is in your homes and in your temples. This is a redistribution of wealth, but and again, from those who earned it to those who covet it, but it's upward in its migration, not downward.
Yeah. Well, that's Christianity.
Yeah, that is.
I mean, the Catholic Church didn't build all those buildings because they didn't take people's money.
You know, there isn't a there aren't many paupers among the leaders of mega churches.
No.
There are very few poor televangelists. Why did you move in the direction of crushing and demeaning my people and habitually pulverizing the presence of the persecuted and impoverished, prophetically declares Yahweh, of the regimen of spiritual implements? Why? Man, I'm sure this is just two. You heard them anymore. I think this is written to every Gentile too.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you move in the direction of crushing and demeaning my people? Anti-Semite. Jew hater. So much of the world now is anti-Jew. You know, in the liberal mindset of academia, the anti-Israel movement is really strong.
Mm-hmm.
It's really strong now throughout Europe.
And
of course, it's the dominant feeling, the dominant viewpoint throughout the Islamic world.
Well, I will say I was reading the other day that anti-Semitism in 2017 was up 56%. And so far, this was a report about this summertime, was up 36% more this year than it was to add on to that. So it's growing rapidly.
Look at the numbskull that went into the synagogue and just gunned those people down.
Exactly. That's why I probably...
You've been asking all of us. I'm not asking you and me, because
you know exactly
we love Yisrael and Yehudim.
Yes.
But the preponderance of people, these those who have been misled, why did you move in the direction of crushing and demeaning my people? I know the answer. Do you know why the world became anti-Semitic?
They hate Yahweh.
That's right.
They really do. I mean,
and because there's someone that is far more covetous of Yahweh than any human, Satan. And he is the driving force between human, religious, and political schemes.
Right.
And since Yehudim, primarily, and Israelites, secondarily, serve as Yahweh's witnesses, exclusively as Yahweh's witnesses, and I know the book of Ruth was written by Ruth, but it's a short little book that was... the story of Ruth really should have been told and probably originally was told in the book of Shaphat, Judges. It was probably part of it, not an independent story. And it's a lovely story. But in terms of conveying insights into Yahweh's nature, proclaiming Yahweh's testimony, 100% of Yahweh's spokesmen have been Israelites, mostly Yehudim.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can silence them, if you can demean them, if you can annul their credibility,
then you
precluded people from knowing Yahweh.
Yeah.
So it's a rhetorical question. Why did you move in the direction of crushing and demeaning my people? Think about it. If God loves something, why would you, and he's been very clear about, this is something that I love. As a matter of fact, I want to go so far as to tell you that if you bless them, if you do good things
to them,
for them, with them, Israel, then I'm going to do good things for you. But if you harm them, if you slight them, then I'm going to reciprocate in kind and curse you. With God being so clear on this, why in the world did the preponderance of religious people and political people decide to move in the direction of crushing and demeaning the chosen people? habitually pulverizing.
Because you know what's in, what America's facing.
Yeah. America happens to be the single largest supplier of armaments to the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm.
And all those weapons, of course, will ultimately be used against Jews.
And the mega
world. And Israel. And, you know, here America is, talk about a bunch of hypocrites. It is painfully obvious that the person who orchestrated the murder of the Washington Post writer was the chief administrator, the head of the religious police, the Goebbels, if you will, of Saudi Arabia. He was Crown Prince Mohammed's right-hand man. And they've got him in the recordings as the man responsible for the murder of Khashoggi. And so here is Saudi Arabia at the very head of that country, the crown prince, ordering the murder of a journalist because he didn't like what the journalist had to say about him. In typical Mohammed Islamic fashion. And you know what the consequence is to Saudi Arabia? Why? Because we don't want to harm Saudi Arabia because they might charge us more for the oil they confiscated, and then they might not buy as many American weapons. Greed. We'll sell our soul to the devil for a nickel.
We are sick. Truly.
What a sad story. Habitually pulverizing, boy, I tell you what, that you think of what the Nazis did. What do you think about the Assyrians did? Do you think of what the Babylonians did?
The Romans.
You think about what the Muslims have done.
Mm-hmm.
Habitually pulverizing. Grinding down. The impoverished. Politically, prophetically declares Yahweh. Yeah, why in the world? Why of all people? Why would the world turn against Yahweh's chosen? So, Kirk, here we are. We've arrived at Yahweh's disdain for religious dress-up. The thing that makes me want to, to be graphic here. I just want to puke every time I see it. I want to scream. I want to throw up. I just want to say, what in the world is wrong with you? Why can't you think? Well, and get out of that religious garb. Do you have any idea that Muhammad was a pedophile, a rapist, a mass murderer, a liar, and a terrorist? Why are you honoring his drivel?
Then
Yahweh said, indeed, the daughters of Zion are self-exalting, they're arrogant, they're hard to understand. They walk with their neck stretched out, while seductively flirting with their eyes. Taking quick little steps, they walk with jingling bangles on their feet. Now, first and foremost, Yahweh can't tolerate arrogance. What do we have to be arrogant about? I've got a lot of enthusiasm. I've got a lot of confidence. You have a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of confidence. They're good things, but I tell you what, when you know Yahweh, you understand his story, you understand what he is committed to do for us, you understand the entire universe and why it exists and how it operates based upon being observant and reading his story, you better believe you're confident. You're empowered. Enthusiastic. But not arrogant. Paul was arrogant. He even admitted he was arrogant. King Shaul was arrogant too.
Oh, yeah.
Arrogance is something God's got no use for. So he says, what in the world do you have to be arrogant about? Jewish women. Why do you walk with your neck stretched out? Why do you seductively flirt with your eyes? Why do you take these quick little steps with your jingling bangles on your feet? Now, Kirk, in my experience, religious women are unduly proud. Boy, is that ever the case with Islam. But it's also true among Jews. And it's an attitude that God detests. Now, feigned love, these flirting little lies, another one of Yahweh's pet peeves. That's why he detests harlots and whores, those who sell sex for money. Got nothing against sex. You know, Yahweh's not a cosmic killjoy like Pauline Christians, like fundamentalist Muslims. Everything you can read is that normal sex between men and women, it's loving.
Yes.
God designed it. He celebrates it. Thinks it's cool. Got nothing against it. But selling sex for money, using sex as a way of manipulating, controlling, and influencing, doesn't like that. So, Gaba conveys not only self-exalting arrogance, it's indicative of a person who's a hypocrite. Feign love. God wants us to walk to Him in an upright, straightforward, steadfast manner, like Jacob, with our heels firmly supplanted. He's not impressed by the flighty fool, someone who skips around and gallivants if trying to bring attention to themselves. You want to make noise? Recite Yahweh's word. If you want to go somewhere, follow his path to heaven. As for our necks, they ought to be positioned such we can look up and focus on Yahweh, not stretched out in a haughty way or inclined in worship, and our eyes should be focused on his testimony, not luring some dupe to bed. Now, so these bangles, they're ekak. They were used to hobble camels, to fetter criminals, and to lead oxen to the slaughterhouse. It's not something anyone should find attractive. These sparkling and jingling anklets were worn to draw attention to the woman's legs, rather than her path through life. So it begs the question. Are those who wear them more fascinated with trinkets than the truth? More inclined to entice rather than inform? To charm rather than love? What did you find, Cam Kirk?
Gosh, you know, 316, I wrote a couple of pages on this stuff. And I wrote at the top of it, I said, you cannot misunderstand Yahweh if you study Hebrew, because if you really do this, and I can get all this basically online with the help of a few hardcover books, and I looked at all the letters as well, and everything you said in there was, and I'm not blowing your horn. I mean, you know where to find the answers. There they are. You connect the dots extremely well. If not terrifically, I'm getting better at it, but I do it independently, but from the daughters to the Zion, the signposts along the way, everything that's there, the haughty, the exhausted, that's the Gabal, exalted and arrogant, he's very plain. There's nothing hyperbole or anything that you put in there that's not there, not easily found there. They raise their head, they stick their necks out, and they even use a reference, one of them is a as an ostrich, with the long neck poking out, just and the lexicon says no correlation why this is, you know. And I'm saying, well, duh, read it there. Everything about the letters is the same. It's all about pride. It's all about walking away or turning people away. It is. Misdirection in the sense of all the jewelry that's being worn. Now, there was a whole bunch of stuff, the jingling bangles of and to rattle and to tinkle, and the anklets with the bells that rattle when they are shaken, from Akos, from Ikis, which is bangles, and or it could be the tethers and stocks of prisoners. They skip along with little steps, they light, brisk steps, they trip coquettishly, fall into the, I'm sorry, I'm being quite crazy.
Yeah, that's like that. How often is to gallivant?
Yeah, it's the government, but it's
taking quick little steps. And you know, the rear balance is important, and people just say, okay, what's God saying about this, you know, skipping around thing? What's the big deal? Well,
because
Israel was named after a guy that dug in his heels.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the path to God is narrow, it's restrictive, it's singular file. Yeah, you really better know what you're doing when you walk down it. You can't be gallivanting. You know, God's not looking for somebody who's going to tiptoe through the tulips.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to walk with him, you better have your back straight. You better be looking, being observant, paying attention. Slip-sliding around.
Well, this is also an overt attempt to be attractive. I mean, to beguile you.
Right.
So it's what religion is. It's what politics is. You know, I'm offering something that you're not going to get.
Right.
By this thing. So it was interesting. All these R words. I mean, with Gale and so forth. And, you know, that's always written going the wrong direction. Quite a few of them throughout this passage.
Right.
And so that's a clue there, too. Gale to Regal, you know, slander. It's a spy. Regal from Regal, from the foot walking away from. And that's,
yeah.
If you look at the
RG,
walking away from,
just the two letters, RG. Regal. Think of Regal, RG. So you've got the head looking at the one letter in Hebrew that is almost always associated with bad.
Yes.
And if Gomorrah.
Now,
for example, the G, you've got to be really careful. If a word begins with G, it's not always bad, but it's usually bad. And here the observant person is looking at the G, that which is bad.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And what's interesting, I thought, was
the
staff is not on leadership, but also where we were talking about the pen, you know, of Dode. So they're not looking at the words that were written. They're not looking at the leadership taking you down the correct path. So they're walking away.
Yeah.
So, and they're, you know, it just, and the other word, for exactly the same way it's written, comes out to be slander, spies. Talk to walk the wrong way. Talk to a learned behavior. Trampling another with the tongue has another meaning. That's right. Trampling another with the tongue. Slanderous. Gosh. You know, it's I would bore you with everything, but going through them, it's such a good exercise to do.
Yeah.
The main thing that I get, that I was getting out of this is, I've been doing this a long time now, so I'm getting not only better at it, which is wonderful, even my little increments as I go. But the main thing is so reinforcing is I saw a show this week, and if you'll allow me just for a second, we saw a show about someone attacking religion. They were attacking, in this particular case, they were attacking Jehovah's Witnesses. And, of course, they don't do the Moed Mikras, but they don't do Christmas and so forth. So that's about all I could say positive about them. But they were very oppressive to their people. And the tragedy, you know, the tragedy of that is people just won't look at They never look at what the all during the show. I'm trying to say, well, you know what the Torah says. If you look there, instead of just, it's one thing just to attack them, and God, that's wonderful that they're attacking them and walking away from religion. And that's step number one anyway.
Right.
And that's wonderful. But if you're not, if you're, where do you go to seek the answers? And if you go to most of these things, it's very hard. You have to spend some serious time to figure this out. Now, you've been kind enough to do so much stuff and offer it so freely.
Yeah. In my experience, Kirk, is those who question religion, who are overt in their open condemnation of religion,
mm-hmm. Yes.
have accepted a religion, socialist, secular humanism.
Yeah.
And they don't recognize that that religion takes more faith. The religion of man takes far more faith and is far deadlier than the religions that they're attacking. It's just that they have wrongly associated reason to themselves when it doesn't belong anywhere in the discussion.
Yeah,
but them or the religious.
I mean, it's fine that you know that the government stinks and lies. And
but don't take it to conspiracy.
No.
They're not conspiring to lie.
They don't even conspire. They just go out and do in California.
Right.
So you know they're crooked from the start. They're arrogant. It's like the priest acting like they're not pedophiles. I mean, like they have a right to do that. But that's not.
Yes.
That's fine that you know when you recognize it and you walk away and speak out on it and you stand up and say, this is wrong. But without a place to turn, it saves you from going to Sheol, but it's not the answer. You don't live unless you know which way.
Well, you have to be careful, but there are some people who have walked away from religion, other people who have disassociated from their government.
Yeah.
But they're either, many of them are now promoting conspiracies, or they're promoting socialist secular humanism, and that's no better than promoting religion.
Well, it is a religion. Well, if
you're both are religious, have a religious flavor, religious zeal.
Yeah. And God, they've killed as many people as anybody. I mean,
particularly the socialist secular humanist, that's the most deadly religion man has ever conceived.
Yeah, it was. My God.
Yeah. 317. Yahweh, therefore, will afflict their balding scalps with lesions, will cause degrading sores which actively remove hair from beards, forming scabs, set upon the crowns of their heads, of the daughters of Zion. Moreover, Yahweh will expose their disgraceful facade. Facade, the doorway on their foreheads, which pivots open, revealing what's hidden inside. Well, so he's getting at the problem is in their heads.
Yeah.
And so why not just afflict their scalps with lesions to demonstrate that what's inside is perverted, it's sick, it's diseased, right? I think that's what it means, but did you come up with a different conclusion?
Well, I found out to what degree. I wanted to see if there was something more to Kafaf or Safak, however you pronounce it, the scabs. And found out it was a malignant cancer, as described as. It's a sore that spreads. It's more than just what it turned out to be was that it was leprosy. So because I started going to all the different verses where it's used, and it's described as this is a scab that in Leviticus 13:7-8, your the scab that's produced, it makes you unclean, and the rabbi or the lawyer was supposed to, the priest was supposed to see it and do some kind of cleansing activity. And then if he came back and he looked at it, then they declared that you were a leper, we call it. And so it becomes a human disease. So I looked up Tepharoth, for leprosy, and it's infected body. It's a feminine noun, by the way. It's a human disease, and it also can be a human garment, which I thought very funny because we were talking about wearing dress-up Christian religious clothing. And it's a fungus or a mold, from tesar, the verb to be struck or stricken by leprosy. So it's more than just the scab on the head like your hair falls out, which is bad enough. I had a lot of my hair fall out. But this is we're talking about, once again, I think we're talking about the plague of death. I mean, they got it.
Yeah.
And this is a heavy indictment throughout this thing on
When the head is covered with leprosy, therefore unclean. When the head is covered with scabs, showing the disease, the negative influence in it. When it's malignant, you know, these are all really, really bad signs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what God is saying. It's going to expose their disgraceful facade.
Yeah.
And so what he's doing is he's putting an outward sign on the host of religion, which is the mind, such that this disgraceful facade is laid bare. It's stripped away. It's exposed.
Mm-hmm. Well, the consequence of that is where you have the flowing. It's also related to the flowing of blood, bloodshed, oppression, the mishpach I think that's the way to pronounce it, mishpach, where it's a veil or a handkerchief or a kerchief. You know, everything you were talking about, this is the fun part to me, and is everything we've talked about, he's relayed again in these words. It may be a secondary, tertiary, or four or five parts down before you'll find that meaning. And I used to look at them and say, why is that there? What does that have to do with any of the things that are above? And then you come to a point like this where they're using the same word, and then you go through this little list after list after list, and you look them all up, and you look up anything that's related. And sometimes what I'm doing now is I go to wherever it was used, especially early in the Torah, to understand how it was used.
Yeah, that's the best way to go.
And I find that that's extraordinarily helpful. Because but thing like this, when you just find all of a sudden it's a veil, a very long veil, or it's a kerchief. And that's rooted in this word that we're using here, where the one before we've been talking about a religious dress-up. You can't be wrong. I mean, it's overwhelming stuff.
Yeah, and now this particular case, just with the scarring on the heads, the scabs on the heads, if you look at the consequence of sexually transmitted diseases, particularly syphilis and HIV, they leave, both of them, leave lesions on the scalp.
Yeah, yes, I've seen it.
So that could be part of this.
And that's quad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Down on the head, scalp.
Yeah. You know,
quadad, which is comes from, also means to bow down, usually in worship.
Yeah.
You know, it's not obvious there, but you know, look it up. That's what it says. Either the head, the top of the head, the crown of the head. It gives you every Yahweh gives you every meaning you could ever. You cannot misinterpret what he said. You have to twist it.
No, if you take the time, you'll find the truth.
Yeah.
That's all you got to do is just take the time. You got to care enough to look for it and take the time, you'll find it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kirk, we're at 3:18. Good stopping point. We've finished broadcasting this evening.
Okay.
I think it's time to say happy Shabbat. We'll be back this time next week. be back here because I'm not celebrating Thanksgiving. I'm going to do what I'm going to try to do from here on out. I'll visit my sons prior to the celebration of those holidays, and I'll be gone before they're celebrated, and life will go on in a way that enables me to spend time with my family and still not be integrated into the religious and political holidays. For me, every day is Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
but
me too.
Not for my country.
Us too. Yeah.
Yeah, not for my country. Yeah, so it's not a political holiday. So it's and Christmas most certainly is not a religious holiday for me.
If you know that that's Talmud's birthday, and you
yes.
Google it, how do you deal with it?
Yeah, in fact, one of the things that popped up in Yashar 15 and 16 was this the reverence for bulls, and particularly as I was dealing with the unearthing, archaeologists have unearthed the Moabite religious sites, and they found bulls' heads everywhere, and so you think about, wow, well, why find bulls' heads? Well, what is the animal that Yahweh uses to most identify his desire relative to his people?
The ram.
Ram, right. Yeah. The ram is a male lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Sheep are very sociable. They're not only sociable with one another, but they're sociable with people, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Kind of easily led. They like to explore. They like to do things together.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a relatively small mammal, not a scary mammal at all. The bull, sharp horns, big, powerful. So, what did Hasa tell him? I've got to be bigger and more powerful than Yahweh. He picked the bull to be his symbol, just as Yahweh picked the ram to be his. And, of course, Easter is predicated on the sun crossing the constellation of Taurus the bull.
Mm-hmm.
It's the celebration of Taurus the bull, the god, the guise of God. And 9 months later, once the bull has impregnated Mother Earth, the sun's rays have impregnated Mother Earth, the son of the sun is born, Christmas. So by celebrating bulls' images within the Moabite religion, they're exposing the very core of the deception that is Christianity.
Yeah.
Oops.
Oops, yeah.
Oops, think it through, people. This is not a good spot to be.
Well, now that they just said on and on and on and on how much he hates religion.
Yeah.
You gotta draw the line in the sand somewhere and say this ain't it.
Yeah, and keep in mind all of the stuff that he's condemning in terms of the wardrobe here.
Mm-hmm.
It's all religious dress up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No question about it.
Yeah, God hates religion and he hates religious dress up. And he's going out of his way to describe it here, just as he went out of his way to describe why he hates the Christmas tree.
Yes.
And hates is an appropriate term for all of it.
Yeah. Oh, you know what that is? You know, the parallel is somewhere, maybe it's in 3:18 that I found, where he talks about the fruit of the vine or the fruit of the on a tree. And he talks about where it's the decoration on a tree is the fruit that's on the tree. Juxtaposed to the dead tree with all the glittering lights on it.
Yeah.
I thought that was fun. Yeah. You don't miss a trick.
No. No, he's a really effective communicator.
You ain't kidding.
All right, my friend. I'm going to say goodnight. My voice is beginning to fade.
Yes.
Pleasure to be with you. Boy, it was really fun to finish a chapter. I hope to be able to share it soon. And we'll
look forward to it.
We'll continue next week, right, 3:18. Got it highlighted.
Shabbat shalom. We'll be back.
Shabbat shalom. Good night. Bye.
And good night.
Bye.